overflowing with noise, shallow takes, and information that evaporates the moment you hear it, Selenius Media exists for one purpose: to give you depth. Whether the subject is philosophy, psychology, history, science, artificial intelligence, literature, or the shape of the future, every series we publish is built on one idea: that thinking clearly is a form of survival. You're listening to a Selenius Media production. Our catalog spans dozens of long-form, story-driven shows, from Western moral philosophy for beginners to pioneers of psychology and psychiatry, from AI and uncertain future to the classical music giants. Each series is crafted to give you more than facts. It gives you the context, the conflict, and the human meaning behind the ideas that shaped our world. If you enjoy this program, explore the rest of our library. Every show is designed to stand alone, but together they form a larger project, a guided tour of the forces, intellectual, emotional, political, technological, that built the world we live in and the world we're about to enter. Visit the Selenius Media channel to discover new series, follow your favorites, and support the work that allows us to create long-form, high-fidelity, educational storytelling. And please leave comments if you enjoy our shows. Now, let's begin. In a quiet Roman house in the middle of the 3rd century of our era, a man who did not want his birthday known and did not like to be painted sat surrounded by students, talking about how the soul could return to its true home. Outside, the empire was groaning under pressure: political instability, plagues, frontier wars, a sense that the old gods and old institutions were losing their grip. Inside, this man was building in conversation, one of the most ambitious spiritual metaphysics the West would ever know. His name was Plotinus, and though he never set out to found a school, later generations would call his system Neoplatonism. In the long story of Western moral philosophy, he is the one who radically interiorizes ethics, making the good life a matter of turning inward and upward toward an ultimate source beyond being and thought. Plotinus was born around 204 CE, probably in Lycopolis in Roman Egypt, though he disliked speaking about his origins. What we know of him comes mostly from his devoted student and later editor, Porphyry, who wrote a short biography to preface the collected works. As a young man of 20-something, Plotinus found himself dissatisfied with the teachers available. He went from one philosophical circle to another, listening, questioning, feeling that none reached what he was unconsciously seeking. Then, someone suggested he go hear a certain Ammonius Saccas in Alexandria. Plotinus went, listened, and announced to a friend after the first lecture, "This is the man I was looking for." He stayed with Ammonius for 11 years. We know almost nothing about what Ammonius actually taught. He left no writings. But from Plotinus's later work, we can guess that Ammonius represented a living Platonist tradition, in which Plato's dialogues were read alongside Aristotle, the Stoics, and various religious currents, including Middle Platonic and perhaps Eastern ideas. For Plotinus, this tradition offered more than argument. It offered a path of ascent. Around the age of 40, Plotinus joined the Emperor Gordian's ill-fated campaign against Persia, hoping to encounter Eastern sages in person. The expedition collapsed. Gordian was killed. Plotinus barely escaped with his life and made his way to Rome. There he set up a kind of informal school. He did not stand in public like a sophist. He received visitors and students in his home, where he lived modestly. He took in orphans, managed their inheritance with care, and was known for personal kindness and integrity. He refused to sue anyone, even when treated unjustly, because he thought going to court degraded the soul. When a painter tried to capture his likeness, he grew impatient. The portrait, he said, was of the outer man, which did not matter. Plotinus wrote treatises in response to questions and debates that arose in these seminars. He did not polish them for publication. It was Porphyry who later arranged them into 6 groups of 9 essays each, the Enneads. Out of these rather occasional writings, a highly unified vision emerges. At its core is a threefold structure of reality: the one, intellect, and soul. Each level is not a separate thing in space, but a mode or hypostasis of being, a way in which the ultimate principle expresses itself. At the summit stands the one, or the good. Plotinus takes Plato's hints about a form of the good beyond being and blows them open. The one is not a god alongside others, not an object among objects, not even a mind thinking thoughts. It is beyond all categories, beyond being, beyond thought, beyond all predicates. Whenever we say it is this or that, we fall short. It is absolute simplicity, sheer unity, the source from which everything else flows. It is not a person with moods or plans. It does not decide to create. It overflows, like light from the sun, by necessity of its perfection. The next level down is intellect, or nous. This is not intellect in the thin modern sense of abstract reasoning. It is the living realm of all the forms, the timeless patterns or archetypes of everything that can be. In intellect, subject and object are one. It is a mind that thinks all intelligible realities, and those realities are its own thoughts. It eternally contemplates the one, and in contemplating, contains the whole ordered structure of reality. From intellect comes soul. Here again, soul is not just your individual psyche. There is a world soul, the unified living principle that animates the whole cosmos and connects intellect with the physical world. From the world soul, individual souls emerge, the distinct centers of consciousness and life that inhabit bodies, human, animal, perhaps even starry. Soul is double-faced. Turned upward, it contemplates intellect. Turned downward, it shapes matter, organizing the flux of the physical world into forms. Matter in Plotinus's scheme is not a positive substance with its own independent being. It is the lowest limit of emanation, sheer potentiality, almost nothing. The physical world we inhabit, the changing, perishable, particular world, is the last ripple of a cascade that begins in the absolute unity of the One and descends through intellect and soul. Existence is like a light that grows dimmer as it passes through layers. The higher something is in the hierarchy, the more real it is. The lower, the more shadowy. This cascade is not a temporal story. It is not as if the One existed alone for a while and then produced intellect, which later produced soul, which at some later date produced the world. The levels coexist eternally. Emanation describes a logical and ontological relation, not a sequence in time. But for moral life, the picture serves as a map. We, as souls entangled with bodies, exist somewhere near the bottom and can, through a kind of inner ascent, turn back toward our source. Here is where Plotinus's metaphysics becomes an ethics. If the One is the good itself, and every level of reality is good in proportion as it participates in the One, then the goal of our life is to become as unified, as simple, as inwardly collected as possible, to liken ourselves to God, as Plato had put it. For Plotinus, virtue is not merely a set of decent behaviors or civic excellences. It is the gradual reordering of the soul, so that its attention turns away from division and multiplicity toward unity. He distinguishes several kinds of virtue. Civic virtues, justice, temperance, courage, practical wisdom, are the ones the Greeks had long celebrated. They regulate our behavior with respect to others, moderate our appetites, discipline our fears. Plotinus sees these as real, but preliminary. They bring a certain order to the soul at the level of action, aligning our outward life with social norms and basic rational control. But they do not yet detach the soul from its deep identification with the body and its passions. Higher are the purificatory virtues. Here the soul actively separates itself from bodily concerns, not by hating the body, but by no longer taking it as the measure of what matters. The person practicing these virtues withdraws from compulsive desires, from the need for honor, from absorption in sense objects. He or she cultivates interiority, a turning away from the spectacle of the outer world toward the inner life of thinking and self-awareness. This is already a moral revolution, where many Hellenistic ethical systems aimed at managing our engagement with worldly circumstances. Plotinus wants to loosen that engagement altogether. Higher still are the contemplative virtues, where the soul not only purifies itself, but actively lives in the light of intellect. Here the moral life becomes indistinguishable from a kind of philosophical contemplation. To really live well is to live in ongoing awareness of the intelligible order, to see everything in the light of the One. This is not just having correct opinions about metaphysics. It is an experiential reorientation. The soul becomes simple, unified, focused, no longer pulled in different directions by conflicting impulses. It becomes something like what it contemplates. At the limit of this ascent lies something Plotinus describes with awe, union with the One itself. In a few remarkable passages, Porphyry tells us that Plotinus attained the vision four times in the years he knew him. Plotinus himself speaks cautiously about this union. It cannot be described positively, because the One is beyond all determinate content. In intellect, there is still a knower and a known, a subject contemplating an object. In union with the One, even that distinction collapses. The soul does not become identical with the One in a literal sense. There is no fusion of substances, but it experiences, briefly, a state in which all multiplicity and separateness fall away. There is no longer I and the One. There is only a simple, immeasurable presence. For Plotinus, this is the highest happiness, the goal toward which moral and philosophical effort tend. From the outside, this can sound like mysticism grafted onto philosophy. But for Plotinus, the ethical implications are concrete. If reality is structured as he says, then immoral life is not just disobedience to rules, it is a form of ontological self-betrayal. When we fixate on bodily pleasures, wealth, status, or revenge, we are hooking our deepest self to what is least stable and least real. We are, in effect, trying to plant our sense of worth in shadows. No wonder we suffer. The things we cling to are always slipping away. To live well is to anchor ourselves higher up the chain, to seek stability where stability actually is, in what does not change. This leads to a distinctive account of evil. Plotinus rejects the idea that there is a positive principle of evil opposed to the good. The One, as absolute source, can only give being. It cannot produce a pure counter-being. Evil, in his system, is a kind of lack, a privation of form, order, and measure. Because the emanation from the One grows dimmer as it descends, the lowest levels of reality are furthest from perfection. Matter, as almost nothing, is the seat of evil, not because it is bad in itself, but because it is maximally indeterminate, maximally open to disorder. Moral evil, cruelty, injustice, intemperance, is a disorder in the soul, a turning of the rational part away from intellect toward identification with the lowest. When we act viciously, we are not expressing some positive, substantial force of evil. We are failing to actualize the good that is possible for us, sinking toward non-being. The remedy is not to fight some dark entity outside us, but to restore order within, to realign our attention and desire with the higher. This view of evil will have a long afterlife, especially in Christian thought. Augustine, in particular, will take over Plotinus's idea that evil is privation and use it to defend the goodness of God against the charge that God must have made evil. If what we call evil is a lack of goodness rather than a thing in itself, then the blame falls on created wills that turn away from their source, not on the source itself. In this way, Plotinus's metaphysical ethics shapes centuries of moral theology. But even apart from later appropriation, his own ethical psychology is subtle. He knows that the soul is not a simple, homogeneous thing. It has layers. There is the part that descends and is fascinated by bodily life, by images and sensations. There is the part that remains always in intellect, never fully fallen. Moral development is, in a way, a matter of shifting our center of gravity. We cannot literally climb out of our bodies while we live, but we can change which part of ourselves we identify with. When we think, I, we normally mean the bundle of personal traits, memories, social roles, and bodily feelings. Plotinus invites us to relocate that I in the deeper, rational, contemplative principle that is already connected to the intelligible realm. This is why his writings often read like spiritual instruction. He tells his students to cut away what is superfluous, like a sculptor chipping marble to reveal a statue. You are, in his favorite image, like a block of stone containing within it the form of a god. Your task is not to import something foreign, but to remove what obscures your true form. Withdraw into yourself, he says, and look. And if you do not yet see yourself as beautiful, then act as the creator of a statue that must become beautiful. He cuts away here. He smooths there. He makes this line lighter, this other purer, until a lovely face has grown upon the stone. Virtue, then, is a kind of inner craftsmanship. This craftsmanship has social implications, even if Plotinus is less interested in politics than Plato or Aristotle. He does not outline a constitution or discuss the best form of government. Yet his sense that each soul is responsible for its own turning has a quiet political dimension. In a chaotic empire, where external arrangements are unstable, the one domain where you can reliably work is your own soul. That does not mean ignoring injustice, but it does mean that the primary battlefield of ethics is internal. You cannot control who rules Rome, but you can work on which part of yourself rules you. Here his thought intersects with other late antique currents. Stoicism, too, had emphasized inner freedom in a world of external unfreedom. But whereas the Stoic made virtue a matter of rational assent to the logos that governs all events, Plotinus offers a more vertical picture. The rational part of the soul is not just accepting fate. It is climbing out of the realm where fate operates. The body, with its vulnerabilities, remains subject to causes and accidents. The deeper soul, if it truly lives in contemplation, is beyond harm in a more radical sense. They can kill you, a Stoic might say, but they cannot touch your virtue. Plotinus would agree and add, if you have really anchored yourself in intellect, even death is a kind of release, a letting go of the last tethers. The emphasis on inwardness and ascent also changes the emotional tone of morality. Where a rule-focused ethic might emphasize obedience, guilt, and transgression, Plotinus focuses on distraction, forgetfulness, and recollection. Sin, though he does not use the word in a Christian sense, is a kind of amnesia. The soul forgets where it comes from and mistakes shadows for reality. Repentance is remembrance, turning back, recollecting the origin, realigning love. There is less courtroom drama here and more therapy. The soul is sick with dispersion and the cure is collectedness. At the same time, this inwardness carries risks. If you stress that the true self is above the body and the social world, it is easy to slide into contempt for the body and neglect of social justice. Plotinus himself seems not to have despised the material world. He calls the cosmos a beautiful animal, an image of higher realities. Nature, for him, is an expression of soul's power. It is not trash. But he does clearly rank contemplation above action. The highest human life is the philosopher's life, turned away from practical entanglements. For someone building a series on moral philosophy, this is both a resource and a tension. Plotinus deepens the interior dimension of ethics, but he may underplay the communal and institutional ones. His legacy shows up most vividly in Augustine. A young Augustine, troubled by questions of evil and the nature of God, reads books of the Platonists, almost certainly Latin translations or paraphrases of Plotinus and Porphyry, and finds in them a God who is not a huge being among beings, but the source of all being, a light beyond all images. He finds an account of evil as privation, and an idea of the soul's ascent to interior recollection. He will later say that these books taught him, in the beginning was the Word, but not the Word became flesh. That is, Plotinus gave him a metaphysics of transcendence without incarnation. Augustine will baptize those structures into Christianity, making them central to Western Christian ethics. The notion that our true home is not in the visible world, that the restless heart finds rest only in God, that virtue is ordered love. Later medieval thinkers, too, will drink from the Plotinian well, often indirectly. Dionysius the Areopagite, a mysterious 5th or 6th century Christian writer who combines Christian language with Neoplatonic structure, will stress God's unknowability and the need for negative theology, echoing Plotinus's insistence that the One is beyond. All names. Thomas Aquinas, though more Aristotelian, will also affirm the language of participation. Creatures participate in being, which is God, in graded ways, an idea akin to the hierarchy of One, intellect, and soul, though framed in a different system. Outside Christian thought, Plotinus's way of imagining the relation between the one and the many, the inward and the outward, will influence Islamic and Jewish philosophers too, often through Arabic adaptations of his works that circulated under Aristotle's name. The idea that all beings flow from and return to a single, utterly simple source becomes a shared theme in mystical and philosophical traditions across the Mediterranean. For your series, placing Plotinus after the ancient skeptics and materialists makes the contrast vivid. Protagoras and Gorgias undermined claims to absolute truth, emphasizing human measure and rhetorical construction. Pero and Sextus suspended judgment, seeking tranquility in not knowing. Lucretius built an ethic entirely within a mortal, atomistic universe, with no room for an overarching meaning. Plotinus, arriving later, does not refute their psychological insights. He acknowledges the flux and unreliability of the sensory world. But he is unwilling to treat that world as the whole story. He reasserts an objective hierarchy of value, grounded not in shifting convention, but in the very structure of reality. Yet he does so in a way that takes seriously the skeptics' concern about the limits of discursive reason. The one is not something you can prove by syllogism. It is, in a way, the limit concept of intelligibility, that without which nothing would be intelligible, but which itself surpasses intellect. The path to it is as much contemplative and experiential as it is argumentative. In that sense, Plotinus can be seen as absorbing skepticism into a higher synthesis. Yes, reason cannot grasp the ultimate. No, that does not mean there is no ultimate, only that we must undergo a transformation to touch it. Picture him one last time, in his house in Rome, thin and somewhat frail in his later years, his eyesight failing. He is still teaching, still guiding students to turn inward. He speaks gently, Porphyry says, but with authority. A visitor might see nothing spectacular, a small circle of men discussing abstract topics, but for those inside, the stakes are as high as they come. How to live in a crumbling world without despair? How to orient the soul towards something that cannot be destroyed? How to understand evil without conceding it its own kingdom? How to love the visible world without mistaking it for the whole? Plotinus's answer, in its simplest form, is that the good life is an ascent, from dispersion to unity, from opinion to intellect, from self-absorption to a mysterious participation in what is beyond self. Whether or not one shares his metaphysics, the image of ethics as a sculpting of the soul toward greater inward coherence, greater clarity, greater rootedness in what does not pass away, remains one of the most powerful and enduring contributions to Western moral imagination.
Midnight rails under silver moon, dusty boots on a winding road. A shadow's the only friend I've known since she packed up and let me go. Empty whiskey bottle on the sea, her laugh still echoes in my bones. Saddle's heavy with memories. I ride alone where the wind still blows. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Some soul, every town I pass feels half her size. Every trail's haunted by goodbye. whisper prayers to open skies, hoping someday my heart'll find a brand new path beyond the pain where broken hearts can heal in time. Nowhere else to be. 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 No.